Welcome to Women Who Move Nations, the public transport podcast, where we interview our industry's top female executives from Australia, New Zealand, and around the world. I'm Michelle Batsis, your host and the Chief Executive Officer of the Public Transport Association, Australia, New Zealand. We're raising the voices of women for everyone who works in public transport and mobility, and particularly for any of our listeners who are early in their transport careers and looking for inspiration. Each of our guests shares her views on the future of public transport and provides insights into their career journeys. Make sure you follow Women Who Move Nations on your favorite podcast platform and rate the show to help more people find us. You can also join our community on LinkedIn by searching Public Transport Association Australia New Zealand. We're also on Twitter at PTAANZ_, or visit us at www.ptaanz.org. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Women Who Move Nations, the public transport podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Batsis, and our guest today is Dr. Deborah Hume, the National Manager of Multimodal and Innovation at Waka Kotahi, the New Zealand Transport Agency. Deb is also a director on UITP Australia New Zealand's board. Deb, so excited to have this chat with you today. Welcome and thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Deb, you've had an incredible career that has included working with local government to transform public transport services. You led Wellington Metro and you were also at Kiwi Rail as the general manager for passenger, which I think is really interesting. And all of that experience has led you to this role as the National Manager of Multimodal and Innovation at Waka Kotahi, the New Zealand Transport Agency. And I know you've got a huge portfolio, very broad, that covers urban mobility, public transport, urban form, rail and freight, and future transport. And I'd love to hear more about this. Can you tell us about your responsibilities and your priorities in this role?
Well, like you said, there's a lot in there. It's an enterprise-wide function. First, I'd say that we are not even a very huge team because we need to impact change through the rest of the organisation. So whilst you got the titles right, we work with the rest of the organisation to make those things happen in real life. So traditionally, like, you know, maybe a decade ago, much more focus in New Zealand around building roads, and you could squeak in a few cycleways and public transports on those things. Now the focus much more for our government is around emissions reduction. Safety's always been there, so that's of course still in the mix. So my, my responsibility, what I tell people is I work in Waka Kotahi and do pretty much everything that isn't a road. Gross exaggeration, of course, with everyone else. And the reason we all get out of bed in the morning is really for that safety and emissions reduction of the transport system, a big focus for our government at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, New Zealand's held up around the world as a leader in this space around emissions reduction because you've got a national approach, right, which is then filtering down. So keen to hear more about that. I wanted to ask you, you know, in terms of sustainability, which New Zealand, I think, has really set a really impressive agenda around, and that's such a core part of future transport. I wanted to ask you, you know, from your experience, what are the key differences between the current transport ecosystem you have now and what you're striving for? What's that ideal and vision that you're moving to?
Well, first, really complimentary. Thank you for saying all those nice things about us. And look, I am really proud of New Zealand and our work, but I do think it hasn't escaped notice that we are a single nation with a central and single government, which makes pushing our national drives through a lot more easily than when you're in a place with states or provinces like, you know, Australia or Canada. So look, we do have a system that supports a centralized approach. So thank you. We've been trying very hard, but we've also got a few natural benefits there. In terms of what's different, we are really striving for an integrated system approach. One where you're looking at the outcomes you're driving for, and we have a lot of levers at our disposal. So not everyone will be familiar with the scope of Waka Kotahi. So we are the single agency. We own and plan and build and maintain the state highways, but also we are the transport investor for the nation. So the work I do in particular is all co-investment work with local government and Kiwi Rail. So there's nothing my team does that isn't in partnership with others, not just because they run the system and they're in charge of the planning and they've got their own ratepayers to accommodate, but because we have to work together to influence the change. That's quite different than if you run and own your own asset. So that's probably another really thing that's big thing that's different. And I think the way we're pushing forward is just recognizing there's nothing we can do individually. As a nation, it is all in partnership with the people around us. So that integration, where before we might have said Kiwi Rail runs the rail, Waka Kotahi runs the state highway system, the public transport's run in our country by regional councils, the local roading system is run by the cities or the districts. Now we are the single agency across the lot, driven by government direction through our Ministry of Transport, and we are expected to look at it all together and push in a single direction with a single frame to get to those emissions reductions outcomes. So I guess the change would be moving from a slightly more siloed way of thinking into a system way of thinking.
Yeah, but it's actually really fascinating to reflect on the approach that you have in New Zealand and how that's changed and how you've transformed Waka Kotahi as well to be this agency that's really integrated, looking across the whole transport system. And I do want to just acknowledge, I think it's a really important point you bring up about New Zealand, you know, in essence, being a country where you do have that model where you're not divided into states. I mean, I think it's incredible that I understand New Zealand's working on having a national ticketing system. I mean, you know, those kinds of concepts are so foreign, right, to many countries. You know, can't imagine that happening in Australia, even though it'd be so great potentially for customers. So thank you for sharing on that. I wanted to change tack. I'd love to hear a bit more about your career. I think you've got a really impressive CV. I think your credentials are really interesting. And I want to get into that a little bit more because I read that you wanted to be an ornithologist. Can't even say that word, but basically someone who studies birds. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you went on to study psychology and zoology and you did your PhD in biology in Canada. And then you got into risk management consulting when you returned to New Zealand. And I mean, that's super interesting, right? And a lot of your career ended up, though, being in New Zealand's public transport sector. So I just wanted to ask you if you could tell us a bit more about your professional experience and your education and how has that led you to where you are today?
Yeah, lots to talk about there. Well, first of all, I'll confess. So I grew up in farming New Zealand and I laugh because actually one of the reasons I thought I'd be an ornithologist was it was a word that people where I grew up around didn't even know or pronounce. And now I know that's a little bit naughty of me. But when I was growing up in farming New Zealand, I just wanted to do something bigger than that. And that seemed like a cool word. It is that shallow. That said, I was really good at biology and things like that. So my background was really following things I was good at. I needed to move out of rural New Zealand. I think we all knew that. And I just got scholarships to study those things. I got a scholarship to my master's is in conservation biology. I lived in a very remote part of New Zealand doing field work on the world's rarest wading bird. From there, I picked up a scholarship to do my PhD in Canada, which just seemed better than being a barmaid in the UK. I'd like have a fun trip overseas and get a PhD. So look, that's sort of how I progressed. It felt fun and I was stimulated and it meant that I was getting amongst the world. When I finished my PhD, I came back to New Zealand and the Great New Zealand Outbreeding Program, where we bring back a partner and repopulate the small island nation we live in, and did find at that point that I was overqualified and under-experienced. So found work in a place that kind of seemed to be something I could take some of my skills into and would appreciate them. And so for those of you old enough to know The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I basically describe myself as a human babel fish, trying to interpret what engineering people are trying to say to the rest of the planet, like politicians and decision makers, because they're asking for things that the engineers sometimes struggle to hear. And again, very simplistic. But if I was to say, you know, my first job and how I got it was really that I could relate to different sets of human beings and understand the complexity of what they were trying to handle, much like risk management, risks, opportunities, upsides, downsides, being clear in what you're trying to achieve and looking at the big picture, really. So there is a thread of sense through that, but I can tell it's a bit tenuous unless you come from New Zealand. So I'll give you a wee for example. When I traveled just for fun, it is quite fun when you run passenger rail for New Zealand, just get your PA to phone up, you know, the person that runs it for France when you go to France and say, would you like to meet this person when they're in your country in a month? And they always say yes, which is great. And when I went to France, I met that person because they said yes. I was chatting with them and they asked about my background and I said, well, you must have a PhD in rail management or transport or something. And I said, no, I've got one in biology. And they said, whoa, in their French accent, well, we wouldn't let you run our railway system. And I said, well, no, of course you wouldn't, but we live in an island nation. And so we just have less people to choose from. So I'm very excited to be running it, but I do get that it's a bit of a privilege to be me. And not every other country has that kind of opportunity attached to it. And those people that have met me in the membership probably heard that story before, in that New Zealand is a place where opportunities present themselves more than some other countries, and particularly if you've been overseas and educated. It's just a really wonderful place to pick up opportunities and run with them. And Australia, I get, is more that way than some other countries, but places like France, definitely you'd be needing a PhD in transport management.
It's so fascinating, Deb. Thanks for sharing that story. Actually, I really had a giggle to myself. I also really appreciate how candid you're being. And I think that's really important. And it's really the essence of our podcast too, to hear people's stories. And it kind of leads into my next question, because I've seen you quoted in several publications saying, I don't like it when people say they'll do something and they don't. That's why I'm pretty passionate that in this business, we need to be candid about what we can do and what we can't. Hopefully you can kind of recall this quote and what you were talking about in that context. But I wanted to ask you, how do you balance managing expectations? You know, because I think in our sector, in the transport sector, the expectations are coming through thick and fast. You know, they seem to get bigger, actually. But how do you manage that with the other demands that you've got, meeting timeframes, managing the organization's reputation and getting things done so that you are able to actually deliver, you know, because I think there is something around the expectations that are upon us, right? And what is also realistic though for an individual or a team to be able to deliver. Have you got any thoughts that you could share around that?
I do, of course. The quote, which I do remember, but I think I've said it a few times, I generally feel it to be true in terms of trust and confidence. And I think I've been lucky to work in government, in local government, in central government, which have different pressures. In local government, there's real-time people phoning you up in real-time complaining about their individual bus driver on the 12:45 or something. In central government, it's much more the minister's expectations. And then when I've been running an operation at KiwiRail, that just gave me a much better understanding of operations and what it takes to make a change. And some of them, in a commercial sense, are super easy. So in Tourism Rail, I remember learning we were selling beer on our trains just over wholesale prices. And we were not making a lot of money on that service, I can tell you. So I remember phoning up and saying, tomorrow, I just want you to double every number on the liquor sales list. So some changes like that you can make super fast. Some changes, like we've had a government announcement this week that we're going to halve public transport cost across the country, just has higher operational impacts. It takes a lot longer to implement. Yeah. So when it comes to managing expectations, I feel pretty lucky in that I understand that kind of top to bottom needs. So the ministers are not unreasonable. You can go back and go, we can achieve half price fares. It isn't going to happen tomorrow. We'll get back to you on that. Completely acceptable. For a customer, you can, you know, apologize for their bad experience. You can probably, if you need to, refund or something, and make a commitment to making it better if you work on that as an organization. So for me, it's a little bit about where on the system you're operating, what kind of challenges you're being asked to do. You certainly need a team around you that can support the work, and a large management responsibility is to get that team right. And then I think you be as honest and as swift in your communication as you can possibly be. In New Zealand, one of the things we do have is we've got a really fast feedback loop. People are not afraid to tell you how they feel quickly. So there is an opportunity for improvement if you're genuinely motivated for it. And if you are not, they catch on. And then you're in deep trouble. Fixing a problem early is always better than letting it fester. It doesn't actually matter if that's at a political or at a individual customer level. I think it remains true.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thanks for sharing on that. And hey, also, as a on the side, really interesting about the 50% off the fares. It'll be interesting to monitor how that goes and the impact that has on ridership, but also just people's ability to get around. I think a number of countries will be watching that.
Yeah, well, just to be clear, the reason for that was, look, the cost of living's a little bit problematic here at the moment, the Russia-Ukraine impacts on fuel. So it's designed for a short period, so 3 months, to just relieve some of that pressure. But yes, you won't be surprised to hear that there are some significant operational impacts in making that happen.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And we've got the issue with the rising cost of petrol here in Australia as well. I wanted to ask you, you know, in terms of your career, we've been talking a bit about that. I know you've achieved some amazing things. You've really done some very interesting roles, Deb. And I wanted to ask you, is there a project or initiative that you've worked on that you're most proud of?
Definitely, yeah. So I would say my time at KiwiRail was my most challenging but also my most rewarding role. That was a time, there's a lovely quote somewhere as well. It thinks when I got that job, I think it said I had the worst job in New Zealand. And then there's some great front pages of our national newspaper, or at least the one that comes in Wellington, which all the politicians read, about just how bad Metro Rail in Wellington was at that time. So definitely a case of coming in from a position where you couldn't go any lower. I do remember one headline, one front page was on Black Friday actually in August, and I took it back to my team. I said, we are not going any lower than this. We are only going up from here. We moved customer satisfaction tens of percentage points. I had engagement levels in my locomotive engineers. For every one engaged one, I had eight disengaged. I'd never seen statistics like that before. So that means for every one person that likes coming to work, you've got eight people, frankly, just rowing in the opposite direction. People in my morning tea rooms would tell me what lies they're told to passengers that day just for fun. So we were coming from a very, very unusual and dissatisfied place. So when I left there, I'm really proud of the fact that the customer engagement was up. As I mentioned, that the staff engagement was way up. We had righted a business that wasn't doing very well financially. That's part of some of those tourism stories I told. The change there was much more rapid than I expected, but I'd have to confess it's because it was at not a very good level at the beginning. So as a turnaround project, as something that I found really, really rewarding, extremely testing. It was my first time dealing with a national union. Man, did I learn a lot. But I was really proud of watching the metrics move. So, you know, you can feel something's moving in a role, but I made sure that I measured things in the beginning and I monitored over time. I remember meeting with my chief executive in the first, probably my second month there. I took a KPI chart and he just looked at me and said, whoa, you love these KPI things. And I said, dude, actually, I want us to agree that this is how it is when I start. And I want us to notice over the next few years if things get better. That's probably something I'm doing, rather than not knowing that and kind of feeling it's moving and not really having a way to attribute it to the actual work that the team and I were putting in. So there's method in my madness there.
Very interesting. And I love it. There is method in your madness. Interesting the way you kind of talk about how things kind of happen in New Zealand, but also the opportunities you have, and then those examples that you find yourself in. Really interesting. I wanted to change course and talk a little bit more about women in transport, leadership. And I mean, as you would know, you know, this podcast, Women Who Move Nations, we started it around being able to profile women and inspire others, particularly those who are coming up through the ranks. And now we have an audience actually that, you know, is a mixture. It's not just women who are listening, but lots of people who are looking to learn more and develop their careers and hear more about the future of transport. And I wanted to ask you about mentoring, because we often talk about this and we often hear about its importance and how mentoring can be particularly helpful for women to achieve their professional goals. And I wanted to ask you, what has your experience been with mentoring? And indeed, do you have a mentor or people you admire or model yourself on? And are you mentor yourself at the moment?
Yeah, good question. Well, definitely mentoring is cool. But so is coaching. So I'll describe the difference there. So I have a coach at the moment. So they are sort of professional people that help you navigate your career and progression, whereas a mentor to me is much more someone who's done it before, who can provide you sort of the advice. So I have both, definitely not in a formal way. As a mentor, I like to run a wide network. I like to share my pain and my gain widely. I guess I would say I did take a hard look at myself. It was when I was at QRL actually, and noticed that all of my colleagues and many of my friends were men 15 years older than me, and thought to myself, this does not seem statistically right for a start. There are just more women in the world than that. And I also reflected that it was getting to a point where what I needed to learn, they couldn't teach me. I couldn't observe in them. Another fun story, same guy, Jim Quinn, a great man, chief executive of QRL. I hope you won't mind me telling this story, but one of the days I'd had quite a challenging interaction with the union, and I remember him giving me his advice about how he'd handle it. And I just looked at him and I said, Jim, we just need to remember you are 6'5", nearing 60, the chief executive and a man. So I'm thinking pretty much nothing you've just said to me I can pull off. So that kind of just reinforced to me that I was going to have to be much, much, much more purposeful about seeking out female models, really. I didn't have many around me. So there's an organization in New Zealand called Global Women. And it's a leadership, it's a not-for-profit, it's motivated by helping women up the ladder, it's mixed commercial, NGO, lots of different and really amazing women. And I found a way to become a member of that group, and I've personally found that really, really rewarding. Women in very senior roles who can give advice or at least demonstrate, and you can watch doing it their way. And even if you can pick up some and tailor it to your way or a way that you think will get you where you need to do in terms of the outcomes, it's not about climbing the ladder, but you know, how do you have a difficult conversation when there's an obvious power imbalance? Or here we have mana as a word, is where you have your personal gravitas is different, or there's a perception difference. You know, those things I've consciously looked to grow probably in the last 15 years, just again recognizing I didn't have it around me and I'd need to go looking for it.
Yeah, very interesting, isn't it? And I mean, it can be hard in particularly in some kinds of roles, you know, because let's be honest, transport is still a male dominated industry. I mean, and you particularly see that, I think, on the operational side as well. There is some change happening, there's no doubt, but you do need to seek out the females around you, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I have a group, we call it the Leaning In group. When the book Leaning In came out, I'm a member of the Institute of Directors, and a few of us got together. We go on a retreat every year, which actually we do some work. We'll go on, they're all directors of different companies, so we'll go and visit the companies. But there's a lot of, you know, dinners and wines and talking work, which is great. It's certainly not a knitting circle. So there's more opportunities, I think, if you look for them or set them up yourself, to get that professional support and the opportunity to say, look, this weird thing's just happened to me, and bounce it off a few people. So again, I've been really purposeful about setting that up. And yes, I always take the opportunity to mentor. So I am mentoring some other people at the moment. And really that's, I would say, a sounding board, trying to work out where they think they're at and what I can do to support them in that, or even sometimes just hold up a mirror if that's what's needed.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, though, the ability for a mentor to help sounding board, hold up a mirror. But also I think, you know, there's something in it around just encouraging someone too, right? I wanted to ask you a question, which is around confidence. And so often women find it challenging to advocate for themselves and be confident enough to pitch themselves for a more senior role or that new opportunity. And I wanted to ask, have you got any advice for how women can look to position themselves, and how can they negotiate their salary once they've got the opportunity on the table?
Well, I can tell you really clearly what I did, and it's because I'm a scientist, really, so I just go empirical on it. So I remember looking around, and look, I told a short story about my credentials, and I finished my undergrad and I looked around to see who was going to be my managers. I'm like, whoa, I'm not really sure I want to work for them. Better get some more qualifications. Did the same in my master's, same outcome. did my PhD and like, okay, this is looking better. This looks like I can enter the workforce in a place that might work a bit better for me. And then it didn't take me long there. And then I entered at a kind of an engineering level. Great professionals, you know, fantastic people. And I didn't really know my worth either. So I just researched it. And the words people use of imposter syndrome, I've actually just never felt that. I get that lots and lots of people do, and perhaps I'm just missing that gene, but I kind of just look around and go, okay, well, that person's doing well or not so well, and they're getting paid about this because I kind of did the benchmarking, and I reckon I'm doing at least that well, possibly better. And I've just, when I go to negotiate, I have that information, so I take it to the table. And that helps a lot because it's not emotional. I don't feel like I'm pushing for me. I'm just asking for what's fair. And if I'm early in the role, in fact, when I took my first role, I said, look, I actually don't have very much experience. How about you pay me at the bottom of the band, but we'll have a review every 3 months. And if it's going well, you'll pop me up. So they did. And I think I doubled my salary every couple of years. I'll tell you how low I started, but I kind of worked it in a way that I felt comfortable enough that I'd demonstrated value and it was getting recognized rather than pushing a barrow that I might not really believe in. And you might need some buddies around you. I used to offer a service for my friends before their salary negotiations. We would go out and just sort of go through what their rationale was, if they wanted a lift. They often didn't, but I'd do a bit of benchmarking research and go, no, I think you probably should. I think you're a bit out of whack here. So yeah, get some friends that are going to be on your posse, on your negotiating team, and maybe go in tomorrow after that chat and have the chat with your boss. And I found that faced with evidence, I've never really had too many struggles, evidence and performance clearly, about having people respond appropriately. And as a manager, look, I do see it. I see males traditionally looking for a raise every year, irrespective of performance, and women barely mentioning it, if at all. So I think there is a little bit of an unwillingness to talk about it, but I think we should. It's part of the what you come to work for. So put it in the job spec and make it part of how you think of being a professional.
Thanks for sharing, Deb. I appreciate you being so candid and transparent about your own experience. And there's some really good advice in there just around doing your research and also using your friends, you know, like using your peers and the people close to you. You know, I'm actually a really big believer, you know, as I kind of become more senior in our career and what I see around the pay discrepancies is that we do need to share with each other and also support each other, because otherwise that gap, I think, becomes bigger too. So thanks for sharing on that. I appreciate it.
Well, I have one more just to demonstrate that it's not easy. I mean, when I went for the Kiwi role and won it, I remember telling my family and my father, Derek says, whoa, are you not embarrassed? Well, what are you talking about? But he says about how big that salary is. You know, it was an executive salary. This is my father speaking. I said, Derek, dude, like, well, I guess I could turn the job down, but then they'd hire a candidate that's frankly not as good as me, or they would have hired them anyway, is probably going to be a guy and they're probably going to pay him more. So no, I'm not embarrassed. But it was funny, that chat with my dad.
It is funny, isn't it? I wanted to ask you another question. It's about career planning. It's a real favorite question of mine, actually. Always like to ask it. Do you plan your career? So do you have a 5 or 10 year plan you're working towards, or do you just prefer to take the opportunities as they come?
So I do plan my career, although there's times where that gets a bit tricky. I have a son, and so there are parts where parenting, depending on how it's going, how everyone's health and well-being is, can make you make other choices. I was lucky enough that all went pretty well and my career plan could truck along. So the plan was not so much that I had an aim. So I don't have the employer I want to work for before I retire sort of thing, but I like to be challenged and I like complexity and I like going places that need help. So that is a bit of accepting opportunities. And so the other edge of the New Zealand double-edged swords is that when you get senior, there just aren't that many of those opportunities, and people stay in roles for a long time and entirely as it should be. So my career plan at the moment probably has changed because at a certain level of seniority, you do need to wait for those roles to open up. And we're not in an expansionist mode. And so it's got a little bit harder, but you can still be planful. You can still be clear about what you're aiming for and what you won't accept. But probably a little bit more of moving sideways or accepting opportunities in different sectors or in different environments to sort of round me out a bit more. It's not so much about an upward trajectory so much as it is a rounding out trajectory for me at the moment.
Yeah, that's a really nice reflection. I hadn't thought about it in that way, the rounding out trajectory. Thanks for sharing on that, actually. It gets me thinking too, you know, because it's not always the climb up, you know, and others talk about the kind of you going up steps, if that makes sense, you know, and sometimes you might take a side step. But this concept of rounding out is kind of the broadening, isn't it? And the kind of experiences and opportunities that come with that.
I think it provides a great offering as well, and particularly for women, is you can still grow and contribute. Look, if you are looking for chief executive roles, which, you know, might be in my future one day, they are looking for people who are rounded. There is an age gap. I'm sure it's the same in Australia, where quite a lot of our senior people are retiring now. And looking to move into those places, I think you need to have that breadth, if you can, will help. You know, if you've worked in different sectors, commercial, central government, if you've worked through an operational area or a corporate support area, I think it all helps you be a better one of what you want to be.
Yeah. Thanks for that advice. I think our audience will really appreciate that. And I wanted to ask then my final question, which is advice related. What would be your top piece of advice for early career female transport professionals? Probably applies across the board too, right? Because, you know, I think career advice is, it can be relevant to everyone.
Might be a bit of a Debism, but I reckon just get amongst it. And I mean, like, in every way, if you're motivated, if you can. So I came back to New Zealand and was looking for roles. I joined professional societies. I found people to talk to. I did volunteer work, like, get into it. And you might not love it all, but that will also tell you something about, I'm kind of more of a technical path person rather than maybe a management path person. I can accelerate your learning of the sector if you just, I run it as a bit of an experiment just for myself, you know, low stakes experiments. I don't do anything too rad, but give yourself the opportunity to go faster by spreading around what you're looking at, what you're doing, seeing if you can step up, take those opportunities, lean into people that look like they'll give you some time. Now, if you're serious about it, then get amongst it.
That's awesome advice. I love it. Get amongst it. It's so true, isn't it? You just got to give things a go.
Different personality types for different approaches, right? But I think, like, a professional approach requires a bit of energy. It's also entirely fine to decide you want great work-life balance and say, I've got this work in a box over here and I'm going to do this in the rest of my time. So, you know, my advice is probably for someone who's happy for work to encroach more than, say, 40 hours a week. But I was, and I find it really stimulating.
Really good advice. Thank you so much for sharing, Deb. I wanted to ask you, is there anything that you'd like to share or any final words for our audience?
First of all, I'm really excited to be on UITP. It's great to have this cross-nation. I'd already had networks across the countries, but it's great to formalise that and make sure we connect a bit more. I'm looking forward to doing that in coming years. I have recently connected with, I'm not sure what we call it in UITP here. We have an emerging grad, that's what we call it in Waka Kotahi. But the thing I would share is that when I meet young professionals or people coming through the professional track, I'm just so impressed with what I see about how seriously they're taking it, how they come to the table already with those expensive climate change kind of thoughts. Like, it just gives me heart that we've got a thriving industry and makes me really keen to support and grow people in it. I remember a bunch of years ago, engineering firms would say, oh, yeah, we used to have whatever percentage or something. Like, used to. I'm like, what did you do to them? So it's not enough to get people in the door. We have to keep them. So, you know, I think the retention in the area I work in particular is really high, but in some other areas and some workplaces, it's mixed. So I think our responsibility as leaders in the profession is to identify talent, to nurture it, to give it the conditions to thrive, to mind it through the whole system. It's a vocation for some. I probably call it a profession for me. But in rail, there are people that are rail people. And, you know, there's a place for every kind of disposition in the transport sector. And I'm just really heartened to see it in good health.
Yeah, me too, Deb. You know, actually, and you probably met a couple of our emerging mobility leaders because we have a committee, you know, that we've recently established. And I mean, they're just so excited to go and do things and for us just to provide that platform. And you mentioned a couple of things really important, right? It's the retention. So the attracting the talent into the industry, but it's the retention as well. So it's great to hear that you've got a high retention rate. Deb, thank you so much. Really appreciate you sharing about your priorities at Waka Kotahi and also about your impressive career and what you've learned along the way. So thank you and bye for now.
Thanks, Michelle. Bye.
That was Dr. Deborah Hume, the National Manager of Multimodal and Innovation at Waka Kotahi, New Zealand Transport Agency. I'm your host, Michelle Batsis, and you've been listening to Women Who Move Nations, the public transport podcast. I hope you'll join us again soon.
Thank you for listening to Women Who Move Nations, the public transport podcast. This series is produced by Dylan Adler with copywriting by Sophia Dickinson. Thanks for joining us as we profile women working in public transport and sustainable mobility and inspire the next generation of female leaders. I'm Michelle Batsis. Keep safe and keep our nations moving.